From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Brain Awareness Week at the University of Iowa, and in the first half hour, my conversation with visiting brain scientist Dr. Donald Stuss of the Rotman Research Institute of Baycrest in Toronto. He'll tell us about brain health as we age and the latest on brain trauma, be it on the football field or the battlefield. Then a conversation with the new president of Grinnell College, Dr. Renard Kington. We'll talk about what led the former deputy director of the National Institutes of Health to Grinnell and his vision for one of the top liberal arts colleges in the nation. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest is brain researcher Dr. Donald Stuss. Stuss is a senior scientist at the Rotman Research Institute of Baycrest in Toronto. He has dedicated more than 30 years to the study of human frontal lobe brain function and has made significant contributions to better understanding of the human brain. Welcome to our program, Dr. Stuss.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, during your career as a brain scientist, you have focused specifically on the frontal lobe of the brain. This is the part of the brain that is right behind our forehead, if we would grasp that. I'd like to ask you to begin by telling us a little bit about the frontal lobe and how it's different than the other parts of our brain.
The frontal lobes obviously are at the front, and I will let you know that the back part of the brain is not called the bactal lobes. There are four lobes in the brain. There's the frontal, the parietal, the temporal, and the occipital. And the unique feature of the frontal lobes is that all information from every part of the brain gets to it, gets to the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes has reciprocal connection with all of the rest of the brain, which means it is in a unique position to integrate information from the rest of the brain, to make decisions, to analyze things. And it is also the part of the brain that is the most developed and the latest developed within animal species.
Mm-hmm. So within animal species, do all species have a frontal lobe?
All species do. All animal species have a frontal lobe, but the development and size of it varies.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that the frontal lobe has to do with our self-awareness, the very fact that we can talk about the fact we have brains and other things that have to do with self-awareness. How does the frontal lobe give us self-awareness?
What you've asked was probably been the mystery of the frontal lobes for years and years. People have always called it the seat of wisdom, have called it the center of self, have called it the uniqueness of being. The problem is, how do you study that? How do you study self? How do you study awareness? There are several ways of doing it. One is by seeing unique patients, people who have had, for example, an injury to the frontal lobes and who are willing to come and understand what's happened, and the family is willing to have this investigated. And I'm going to give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
This was of a gentleman who I'm going to give you details because this has actually been on television, so there's now no confidentiality here. So he's allowed permission of this. Anyhow, it was a truck driver who had apparently fallen off the truck. He was missing for hours and then finally comes home after about 12 hours and goes to sleep, and nobody knew where he was, and he couldn't remember where he was, where he had been. Went to the hospital, and it is surmised that he fell somewhere, probably unloading the truck, and fell on his frontal lobes and had a very small contusion or bruise right in the very front part of the frontal lobes. This is an area of the brain that is absolutely the latest part of the brain, area of the brain to develop.
And between your eyes.
The whole front, right between the eyes, right in the very front.
The forehead. Mm-hmm.
And we have the largest area, I'll call it area 10, because that's one easy way to differentiate. It's called area 10 in the front. We have the largest area 10 than any other animal species, including monkeys, chimps, etc. I'll come back to the monkeys in the fight. Don't you have to remind me because I'll forget, because that's an important part of the story. What this gentleman did was recover perfectly fine, except he had a change. And it wasn't a unique change. It was a lack of sensitivity to his wife, his family, and others. And his wife said his self was changed. And it was kind of a very, what this idea of a personality change. But what he did was no longer care about anything. And when his wife gave the example, when he would come home, he would immediately, before his accident, sense if there was something wrong. Now he would come home, not pick up anything, not understand at all any cues. What that means, and this is part of the idea of understanding, what he can't pick up is the external cues to interpret through his own feelings to go back to understand the other person. And that's called, to some degree, theory of mind, to take through yourself what you have experienced to interpret the feelings of others. So now let me give you an example I said about the animals and how this changes.
This goes back to the monkeys.
Goes back to the monkeys. People have always said animals have self-awareness, right? And people say, well, listen, I go and my dog goes by in a mirror and he reacts. You know, he'll look in at the mirror and say, right. And so people have tested this for years. And people have said this about monkeys. And monkeys know things. And so somebody did a test by saying, can a monkey use a mirror? And they've done it with species all the way up. And how did they test that? Well, what they would do is they would take the monkey and mark the monkey with a small, when the monkey was sleeping or whatever, with a small red dye on the wrist, but also on the forehead. When the monkey would see the red dye on the wrist, he would say, what the heck is this? And start to scratch it. When the monkey then they put a mirror then, and the monkey would look in the mirror and think it's another monkey because he would not react to the red dye on his forehead or her forehead, meaning he did not see the fact, have the awareness that the mirror was projecting his self, that this was another. Now, the chimpanzee, on the other hand, when they did the same experiment with the chimpanzee looks in the mirror and goes, what the heck is this? And starts looking at the red dot. There's the difference in the evolutionary perspective. But the chimp is very clearly different from the human in the human's constructs of self-awareness. So there are layers of development. And gradually, through this type of research, we've been able to start to differentiate what is self. You have to come up with an experiment. How do you come up with an experiment to do this? So we tried to do this mirror experiment in humans. Here's the problem. Humans use mirrors all their life. So if somebody has a damage there, they know it's a mirror. In other words, it's a knowledge-based thing, so you can't come up with something different.
If you just joined us, my guest is brain researcher Dr. Donald Stuss, a senior scientist at the Rotman Research Institute of Baycrest in Toronto, visiting Iowa. He has dedicated more than 30 years to the study of the human frontal lobe. Is it lobe or lobes?
People use it both because the fact is that the brain is split in half by a fissure, so you have left and right. So sometimes people say lobes, other times people say lobe, taking it as a whole.
You had the example of the truck driver who fell, and we gathered some information out of that. And this is the way you've been studying brains for many years. I understand it's called the lesion method.
Correct.
That you find anomalies in a brain, something has happened with the brain, and through that case study, we learn more about the brain. Now, in our news, I'm sure you've been following, we hear a lot about brain trauma in the news, returning war veterans who've been in a Humvee, for example, when there's been an IED that has exploded, no apparent injury, but some sort of brain trauma, all the way to parents now very concerned about high school, college students playing football, contact sports. I'm wondering, when we hear this and this is thrust into the news, is this new science about brain trauma, or is it simply new to the popular media?
It's new to the popular media. We have spent a lot of time studying, for example, the effects of brain trauma. Let me go one step back, because I think you have to get the context of how this works, is that the frontal lobes, because of their interconnectivity, the functions of them are extremely susceptible to virtually everything. So, for example, if somebody has a concussion, the nature of the injury itself affects the frontal lobes most prominently. But it also affects the connections with the other parts of the brain, so it affects the functions through the interconnectivity, damage to the interconnectivity. So we have known this for 20, 30 years. What people haven't been quite aware of is all of the causes of this. So, for example, concussions in sports. And people would say, well, concussions are nothing, but concussions are something. Concussions actually most often do affect damage to the frontal lobes. You would have a damage, for example, blast injuries in the war, and people are unconscious, likely have affected their frontal lobe functioning at some level. Mm-hmm. What's important to study is, what is the level? So, and that is what perhaps is new. What is the impact upon individuals who have suffered this? One concussion, you may recover and you may do reasonably well after. But if you've had two concussions or three concussions or four concussions, they are cumulative. And in boxing, people call this punch drunk, right? You have the,
yes, sir.
You keep on getting hits to the head, which are the same as being knocked out as a concussion of a greater severity. So we are gathering more and more information, and there's more and more sensitivity coming, and there's more and more knowledge accumulating, for example, in sports, that you just don't send somebody back out when they have a concussion.
How do we know how permanent the damage is with one concussion? Say you're in high school football, you suffer two or three concussions over the course of two or three years. Do we know if that's permanent damage?
The bottom line is, if you have damage to the brain, it's permanent. But it's how
period,
much you have,
period.
But what will happen is that if you have a one concussion and it's relatively mild, I would be very hard-pressed to find any deficit after, unless I had been following you for years and years. Mm-hmm. You'll come back to the, quote, normal range. But if you have two, if you have three, if you have four, what you'll do is actually be cumulative.
Dr. Donald Stuss is my guest, brain researcher, a senior scientist at the Rotman Research Institute of Baycrest in Toronto. Let's talk a little bit about aging. What happens to the frontal lobe, to the brain as we age?
It's actually a project that I'm doing now. There is a very prominent theory that suggests, it's called the frontal hypothesis of aging. It suggests that as we get older, that what you will get is greater frontal lobe deficiencies than when you were younger. And part of the reason for that, and goes back, and this is why it's important to understand the anatomy, one of the things that does happen with aging is what occurs that we slow down in our processing. So if you think of the connectivity and we're now slowing down, it means the efficiency of what we do is not as good. And so you might look frontal. We've actually done a study in which we published in 2007 on, quote, normal aging, in which we had this hypothesis that the frontal lobes were dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And we taught people to use their frontal lobes better. We had significant improvement, 30, 40% in some aspects of memory that stayed because we actually taught them as if they were kids to start thinking more efficiently.
So this idea of mental gymnastics works.
It works, but it's not just using it. It's actually learning how to use it. So we actually are, at Baycrest, we're actually doing this stuff on brain fitness. And everybody says, well, you know, exercise your brain. And the answer is yes. But if you learn how to exercise your brain, it's even better.
What about diet? I always hear at home, let's eat some blueberries. Those are good for our brains. Are there certain foods that keep our brains fit?
So let me broaden the perspective. The bottom line is, as you get older, your brain does change, just like your body changes. Mm-hmm. Not as efficient. But number two is, you actually can make it better, and you can make it work better, and you can offset a lot of the effects of aging by doing different things. And I'm going to come at this in a broad perspective to answer your question. For example, Alzheimer's disease. If you have a second language, the onset of Alzheimer's disease is postponed for 5 to 6 years because the fact that you have used your brain when you were younger different. In other words, it's as if it gave it a capacity. There's a cognitive reserve. You may have the same amount of damage in the brain, but the impact of it on your behavior is postponed. So it becomes as a very broad reserve. Now let's take that and from the viewpoint of saying, okay, what can you do with other things that may happen? Well, you need to maximize, just like you have to do with your body, you have to maximize your brain functioning. How do you do that? Number one, physical exercise is absolutely key. Number two, weight. And the reason for weight is all of these affect vascular efficiency, meaning blood flow efficiency, which affects brain functioning. Three is diet. Fat actually impairs memory. Certain kinds of fat impairs memory function. So antioxidants such as blueberries help. Keeping your brain active helps. Minimizing stress helps. There's a total package approach, a life approach to aging in which we can significantly improve our aging functioning.
When will we know everything there is to know about the brain? When will there be no mysteries?
Never. That's
never.
The beauty. Because it's humans are remarkable, and I think we've just started. The goal someday is going to be individualized medicine, or at least proximal individualized medicine. It's also going to be individualized brain health, meaning if you come to me, and if I'm a clinician, you come to me, and I want to understand you as a person, I need to understand not just your cognitive function, but your emotional competence, your theory of mind, your sensitivity to others, your social awareness, your moral compass. We got a long way to go.
What I'd like to do right now, Dr. Stuss, is to throw out some common ideas I think a lot of people have about the brain. I want to lob out a brain idea for you to confirm, for you to bust as a myth, or I guess a third alternative would be for you to say, it's a mystery. We don't know.
I'll do my best.
Okay, here we go. Number one, we only use 10% of our brain.
No, myth. We use a lot more of our brain, but we don't use our brain as efficiently as we can.
Okay, number two idea about the brain is gray matter.
It is gray. That's correct, because there is difference in the – we have what we call gray matter and white matter. White matter is covered with myelin, and it's the connectivity, the axons that connect the different neurons. What we call gray matter are the cells, and they actually are grayish in color. So relative, they're gray and white differences.
Alcohol kills brain cells.
True, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't have a drink or two. It also helps. It depends how much alcohol you drink. Part of the problem is that alcohol absorbs moisture. So if you don't drink a lot, the brain has the most moisture in the brain, in the body. So if you drink a lot, it actually then you end up sucking water from your brain. And if you drink too much, you actually do kill brain cells.
Okay. So the reason to drink a glass of water with your wine is not only so you don't get a dry mouth when you wake up in the middle of the night, but so that your brain doesn't dry out.
You must hydrate all the time, and it's probably the very best technique if you have a hangover is drink lots of water.
Okay. Here's the next brain idea. I want you to confirm, bust, or tell us it's a mystery. Listening to Mozart makes you smarter.
I think that's a myth. There have been research done on that in which people have said that this works, but some of it has been recently kind of debunked. On the other hand, I think there are things in life that do make one smarter, and the exposing oneself to many, many different types of experiences is one of them.
Here's one, a curious one. You get new wrinkles in your brain when you learn something new.
Myth. What you do get in your brain with when you learn something new is greater interconnectivity. And this is important because we talked earlier about the construct of brain capacity and brain organization. As we get older, and this is to me one of the hopes of aging, is that the brain actually is all neuronal cells. And a cell has at the end of the axon, which is the pathway, things called dendrites or connectivities. These sprout, and the nest to connect to the next axon, to make it work, you have to use it or lose it. If you don't use it, the connectivity is weak. So that's why this issue of brain practice is important. What happens in children is actually as important about brain, using the brain and keeping it active, is as important in aging.
Okay, here's another brain idea. The bigger the brain, the smarter the person, generally speaking.
I'm going to call that a myth because women have smaller brains, and I know better than to answer that affirmative. No, the answer is, as I think, it is a myth. What you will get is the denser the brain, the heavier the brain in the sense in relationship, I think you will find a relationship because that usually then means that there is greater connectivity that has occurred.
So you actually want to call someone dense, and that's a compliment.
It's a compliment.
Funny, growing
up. In my language, it's a compliment.
Last thing, you said earlier that we will never solve all the mysteries of the brain, of the mind. Let's assume for one moment that I know everything there is to know about the human brain. I know all the mysteries of the brain that brain scientists have pondered for thousands of years. What is the one question you would put to me?
The one question I would put is, how do we ensure that all individuals in the world have a level of self-awareness and of openness to others, that there would be an understanding of individual differences for the end result of there being, for example, no more war and no more hate?
Do you have any idea of the answer to that question?
I actually do. I think part of it comes through our education. Part of the reason that these things exist is that models of the brain are created through experience, and a model is essentially a value that we may have through experience that are reinforced. And then we interpret everything through those eyes, so it becomes as a lens. People talk about it as the lenses, you know, not in the glasses, the lenses in the brain of how we have prejudice as a prejudgment as opposed to an openness. And we then interpret everything along those lines. I would think, and I don't know whether to say this or not, but nationalism and religions actually, and when they should be, create an openness to growth, often end up having a closedness instead of an openness, and then create distance between others instead of an openness. And I think those things can actually be educated.
Dr. Stuss, fascinating. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Dr. Donald Stuss is senior scientist at the Rotman Research Institute at Baycrest in Toronto. He has dedicated more than 30 years to the study of human frontal lobe brain function and has made significant contributions to better understanding the human mind. Dr. Stuss gave the keynote lecture as part of the University of Iowa's annual Brain Awareness Week. Coming up, a conversation with the new president of Grinnell College, Dr. Renard Kington. We'll talk about what led the former deputy director of the National Institutes of Health to come to Grinnell and his vision for one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. That's when we continue. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Since August, Grinnell College is being led by a new president. My next guest, Dr. Renard Kington. President Kington, welcome. You are the former deputy director at the National Institutes of Health. You have an MD, a PhD, an MBA, have held a number of prestigious posts. With this background, what led you to want to lead a small liberal arts college and Grinnell specifically?
Well, first of all, you know, my career was at the intersection of a number of different worlds, sort of science and medicine and higher education and public policy. And after 7 or so years at NIH and as deputy director, I thought I needed a change. And the headhunters came to me initially about interest in running larger research-type universities. Never had one that quite fit. And then a headhunter actually just called up and said, would you have any interest in running a liberal arts college?
And what did they tell you at that time that your skills, your background would open you up for that opportunity?
Well, they knew that I had broad interests. I trained in medicine but also public policy and health economics. And that was a starting point. And they also knew that I was deeply committed to the value of higher education. And as I was thinking about different things I could do in my career, possibilities in academia as a professor or industry, public policy in other places, I sort of asked myself, what were the things – what did I most value among the options? And without a doubt, it's higher education. My mother's parents were the children of slaves, both of them, my maternal grandparents, who were each the first of their families to go to college. And they became school teachers in a small community in Texas where she grew up. And higher education allowed my mother's family to go from slavery to the middle class in one generation. And I was raised with this in a value system that placed great weight on the notion that education, investing in your mind, was the most valuable thing an individual could do, a family could do, or a community could do. So I fundamentally believed in higher education. And that began the conversation that ultimately led to liberal arts college, such as Grinnell. Grinnell was unique in that it has this dual focus both on being a premier liberal arts college, but also on training students who are grounded in the notion of social justice and with a feeling a mission to actually improve the world, to promote social justice. And that was unusual among the liberal arts colleges.
And that's what attracted you about Grinnell, because I understand you'd never been to Iowa before interviewing for this position.
Never been to Iowa. I knew of Grinnell as a first-rate college. Never been to Grinnell. And my personal training and career had been at institutions that were the antithesis of Grinnell. I was at Ann Arbor undergraduate med school and then Penn for graduate school again and then on the faculty at UCLA. Couldn't think of institutions. It'd be hard to come up with institutions that were more different. But what really impressed me about Grinnell, one of the things that really impressed me was that what they do reflects their priorities. So their commitment to diversity is reflected in the really significant efforts to build a diverse college community in Iowa. And also fundamentally, what I also like the notion that liberal arts colleges in particular are some of the few institutions in the world now, and certainly the United States, that are grounded on this idea of a generalist, that you give this broad base of knowledge that everyone needs to sort of share in some way.
So take that thought and tie it into our job market now, our rapidly evolving economy, into the information age. The value of a liberal arts college like Grinnell in this rapidly changing landscape
has never been greater. And I know that may seem counterintuitive because there seems to be a greater pressure to specialize in every way or as early as you can. But I would respond to that with a couple of points. One, probably the single greatest change in the human experience of the last couple hundred years, in particular the last 100 years, has been the dramatic increase in life expectancy. We are living longer than any humans ever before. Life expectancy on average in the United States in the last 100 years has grown over 60%, doubled for African Americans. And what that means is people are living longer, and the additional years are good years. They're healthy years for the most part, not just years in a nursing home. People are living longer and healthier. And that I think, almost demands that we create an educational environment that prepares people for the longer haul, because I think there's even greater chance, and we are seeing this in evidence, that students will have careers that cut across many fields over the course of their lives. There's a much longer potential work life, and the idea that they'll go to work at the University of Iowa and stay there for 50 years or 30 years, just not as likely as it used to be. So I think that argues even more for having a broad base of skills that will allow you to have the framework to obtain new knowledge and prepare for different fields down the road, for a world that we can't even imagine now.
Civility in politics and in society, or the lack thereof, has been a hot topic in recent years. And I know this is an issue you feel strongly about. First of all, do you think we all have the same idea about what civility is and isn't?
I'm sure there's variation.
So what's your idea of it?
That
where does civility end? And people say, "Well, I don't want a passionless society."
Right. But I think it's a false dichotomy to suggest that there's a trade-off between passion and civility. I think you can be passionate and civil. Our students are passionate about making the world better. But that doesn't mean that we can do it in a way that's uncivil and disrespectful. In many ways, sort of social justice on the big screen is sort of the things like the civil rights movement and when people connect social justice with these big movements. But in many ways, I would argue that there's a complementary view of social justice, and it's about sort of how people are treated on a day-to-day basis. I'm sure if you asked the vast majority of African-Americans who lived in the Jim Crow South about sort of what their primary concerns were about, it was about getting through the day. It was about the way they were treated on a day-to-day basis in many little ways and some big ways. But you have to span that whole continuum of how society functions from the big rules and regulations down to sort of how people interact. And I believe that we are all reduced when we are not able to recognize that people can have different views and still be decent people, even if we passionately disagree, and that as a part of recognizing that our opponents, even people who hold very different views, deserve a certain amount of respect, and that's a part of this social justice idea. It's about decency and respect for individuals.
So what have you experienced, President Kington, yourself experienced or seen that leads you to believe we have a problem with civility?
Well, I'm not sure if we all have a problem with civility. I think certainly Washington does. I think there's wide consensus that the tenor of the political discourse in Washington has become cruder and cruder over the last several decades in particular. I mean, it was always tough. I mean, if you look at some of what happened even in the 1700s, things have been difficult in the past. But I think we've gone back over the last 10 years or so. And I think that often gets translated into a lack of civility in terms of basic exchanges. And I think on college campuses, we have an obligation to help our students be engaged citizens. And I think that a part of being an engaged citizen of a community is this requirement that we have this sort of a floor of civility that supersedes everything else almost.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking this half hour with Dr. Reynard Kington, the new president of Grinnell College. Keeping with the idea of social justice and looking at our news, you're surely aware, of course, that Iowa is one of only a handful of states that allows same-sex marriage. You are in a marriage with another man. The two of you were married in Massachusetts, which also allows same-sex marriage. You have two sons, young ones, I believe.
Yes, 4.5 and 1.5.
And I'm wondering, did Iowa's laws on same-sex marriage play any part in you and your husband's decision to come to Iowa?
Only in the sense that it was consistent with a general picture that we were given of a state that had a tradition of community and respect for civil rights, dating from its early days, in which it was known for its abolitionist communities. It doesn't mean that the state necessarily is uniformly supportive of gay rights or any other civil rights movement. But I do think that it sort of fit with the picture I was given of a state that was thoughtful and open to new ideas, I think the state has a pretty good record in terms of other metrics like investment in public education and health status and public health and other dimensions of as well. So it fit with the general picture, but it was helpful. I mean, at the margin, it probably did make a difference.
So based – you've only been here a few months. You've been in office since August. Based on your brief time living and working in Iowa, how do you evaluate the climate here for gays, lesbians, same-sex couples compared to the other places you've lived?
Well, first of all, I've been living in a very unusual community for any place, and that's a sort of a small college community. The people who live in the communities generally tend to be better educated and more open-minded, to be honest, I think in general. In college towns and more progressive probably. So I've had no problems whatsoever in our community. And that's not to say that there aren't people in the community who might not agree with gay marriage. But in terms of interpersonal interactions, I've had nothing. The entire family is nothing but really a gracious welcoming from the community. And that's been really nice.
Now, last year's Iowa Supreme Court decision allowing same-sex marriage has prompted a campaign to unseat three of the justices who helped make that decision. How do you see this issue?
Well, first of all, let me respond that I will respond as an individual in this to this question. Not
as a university.
Not as the president. Not as the position of the college, because we are an independent, so nonpartisan institution. That's a nonprofit, and we don't get involved in political fights. But we do have principles about that we hold dear about opportunity and equality. And to the extent that this effort to sort of punish those Supreme Court justices who supported this, the ruling – is inconsistent with that value of sort of equal opportunity and fairness, then yes, I oppose it. I think our system works best when in our judicial system, certainly, when we try as much as possible to shield that system from sort of short-term political influence.
How do you think bans on same-sex marriage, which was overturned by this decision in 2009, will be seen in a generation or two? You mentioned the civil rights era.
Yes.
Is that a direct parallel, or how do you compare the two?
Absolutely. I think you've seen in the last 10 years dramatic changes in the percentage of Americans who support laws against discrimination against gays, laws supporting gay marriage. Our former president's wife writing and in support of gay marriage. And we have one of the most conservative lawyers actually sort of supportive of gay marriage. I think that we're having a sea change in thinking. And it, in that sense, it parallels civil rights. I mean, we recently had a visitor to campus, Adam Hochschild, who wrote a book called Bury the Change. It was a history of the abolitionist movement in Great Britain. And what was remarkable about the book is really about how almost ridiculous it was for this group of 12 men who met at a cafe bookstore in London to get together to think about how they could eliminate the slave trade and eliminate slavery in the British Empire when they met in the late 1700s. It was a ridiculous notion, but they were able to affect change, and many of them lived to see those laws passed and to see slavery ended. My father's Jamaican, and my family directly benefited from that. That, in fact, there's a story of my ancestor who was a slave fisherman, and he was out in the water one day in a boat, and he heard bells ringing, all the church bells ringing in the town where he was from. So he rowed back to the camp, the town that he was from, and there was this great celebration. All the church bells were ringing, and it was because finally the word had reached the island that slavery was going to end. So you have this 12 men meeting in a store in the late 1700s in London and effecting a movement that led to the end of slavery and end of the slave trade, and my ancestor being freed, and that led to me being here. So there's this arc of change that began with a bold, ridiculous idea of a group of people who saw something they thought was wrong that they could make right.
So you're patient. You believe in change.
I believe in change, and I have great optimism that we can do great things as a human race.
To finish up here, I'd like to have a couple of questions. This is so interesting that before interviewing for the position at Grinnell College, you'd never been to Iowa. So it gives me a chance to ask you about your impressions, assumptions about Iowa before you were here. And you mentioned that a little bit, but maybe you can share some of those other assumptions that maybe the myth was busted or it was confirmed.
Well, you know, one of the most the books that I've found most meaningful in the last several years was a book called Iowa, Gilead.
Yes, by Marilyn Robinson.
By Marilyn, a professor here,
yes.
In the writer's workshop, and the follow-up to that home. That book actually really shaped my view of Iowa in a lot of ways, in that it in a very subtle way, you know, race and diversity is a subtext in that book's – it's a text. It's part of the – of a key stream of events in those books. So I may have had a slightly more open mind than most about Iowa. I knew that it had a really good university. In addition to Grinnell as a liberal arts college, the University of Iowa has a great reputation. Its medical school is very well regarded. NIH funds a fair amount of work at the Iowa. So I didn't have this – I really didn't have this notion that this was, you know, a remote – you know, part of the country that wasn't connected culturally or in any other way with the rest of the country. But it is a state that is, by some metrics, less diverse than many other states where I've lived. But I don't think I had a really strong bias against the state coming in.
Well, so were there any surprises of any sort?
Yes, there have been a few surprises, but not related to the state, more related to being a college president in a small town.
It's so different than anything you've ever done.
Yes. Even when I was acting director of the NIH, we had 18,000 employees and a $30 billion budget, a big thing. And, you know, I could go a block away from campus and no one knew who I was. I can't do that.
Everybody knows.
Everyone knows. I can be at Walmart at midnight and and I'll run into people from the college or people who know who I am. So that's been the biggest change.
A bit of celebrity.
Small C celebrity. but very different from my previous role. So that's been the biggest change. And Iowa has been it lived up to my expectations of being open and accepting and welcoming. And the town of Grinnell is a really beautiful, charming town.
To finish up here, I'd like you to leave us with the vision you have, because Grinnell College is ranked consistently as one of the very top liberal arts colleges in the United States. What is your vision for building on this success and for changes that you already see?
Well, first of all, it's great that the school is in a position where we're not in crisis mode. Many private schools and public schools are really in crisis mode.
You have an endowment of over $1 billion.
We have a nice endowment. It's not as nice as it used to be. But it's still nice. We haven't laid off faculty. We haven't laid off staff. And so the great thing about that is that I have time to sort of think and to learn the institution and think more about what are the opportunities. But there are areas where I think everyone agrees that the school needs to do a better job. One, reaching out to our alum. Our alumni are remarkable people who deeply love the school. And I think we can do a better job of to be honest, exploiting that love of the school to help us in giving other students opportunity to experience the school. So that's one thing we need to do. I think we can do a better job in reaching out broadly to high school seniors and juniors across the country to consider our school. Now, we're a relatively small school, and this world of elite liberal arts colleges is a tiny slice of higher education in this country. But for the right student, it can be transformative. So I think the more that we can expose the school to students who can think about that and help us sort of get the right students who will be transformed by the school, I think that will help us tremendously achieve our mission if we can broaden exposure. I also think that we need to think a little bit more concretely about how we teach students to learn and relearn for the rest of their lives. Much as, you know, medical schools, when my father graduated from medical school in the 50s, the idea was sort of they would pour the stuff into your brain. You'd take your certification exam once, and that was pretty much it. by the time I came through in the 80s and certainly since then, all medical school has gone to this notion of we're teaching you to learn for the rest of your life. Whatever we teach you now is going to be outdated in 10 years. So we're teaching you to learn.
Learn, change,
and absorb new information and judge information and integrate that information into your lives in all sorts of ways. I think there's room to think about how we do that at liberal arts colleges. I think a lot of that is done already, certainly in the effort to do more so-called inquiry-based learning. For example, learning in the context of research where you're asking a question and figuring out a way to answer the question. So I think there are opportunities for us to do better there. But I think the school is fundamentally doing quite well. So I have the luxury of being able to pause for a little bit and think about how I think I can help the school help itself be better.
Well, Dr. Renard Kington, the new president of Grinnell College, welcome to Iowa. A few months belated in that welcome.
Thank you.
But welcome, and we wish you every success in your new position. Thank you for this conversation. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.